Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem tells us about the emotional reunions between former hostages and their family and friends.
It's actually been very emotional, of course, for the families, but actually for everyone. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Plus, mediator Qatar said on Monday a deal had been reached to extend a truce between Israeli and Hamas forces in Gaza by 2 days.
The agreement lengthens a 4-day ceasefire after 7 weeks of warfare.
And a man pleaded not guilty to attempted murder Monday in connection with the weekend shooting of 3 college students of Palestinian descent in Vermont. Today is Tuesday, November 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. The exchange of hostages during the brief pause in hostilities continues, with Hamas releasing another group of hostages and Israel responding in kind. I spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the emotional reunions between former hostages and their family and friends. Linda, how well is the ceasefire holding up? I understand the ceasefire will be extended 2 more days.
Yes, that's coming from not only Qatar, but from Hamas and from the United States as well, and that it was sort of built into the ceasefire that it could be extended as long as Hamas agreed to release another 10 hostages per day, and that Israel would agree to release 30 more Palestinian prisoners. So it apparently has been extended through Thursday, meaning that after tonight, an additional 20 hostages and 60 Palestinian prisoners will be released.
Do you see any chance of the ceasefire extending past that time?
Well, it's possible that it will be extended another day or 2 or even 3, but Israel insists that it won't be extended indefinitely. Israel has said all along it has 2 goals in this war. The first is the return of all of the hostages, and the second is to make Hamas no longer be able to be a military threat. And there's pretty much a consensus in Israel that if there's a ceasefire put in place now, that would in effect leave Hamas in control of Gaza, and that's something that Israel is not willing to accept. At the same time, you're talking about Israel launching an operation on the south of Gaza, which is where most of the 2.3 million population is now living after Israel told them to leave the north, where you have thousands of Hamas fighters still in underground tunnels. So it's going to be a very complicated military situation if Israel does go ahead and resumes the fighting.
Linda, I've been curious about this since this began. Could you fill us in on some of the details of the return of the hostages, from the families waiting for the hostages' return, the hostages themselves, any information on how that has been going from a personal level?
It's actually been very emotional, of course, for the families, but actually for everyone. I mean, it's pretty amazing. The hostages, especially the children, their faces were on posters all over Israel. I mean, you couldn't walk 100 meters without seeing a poster of these children. And then to see them come back and be reunited with their families. And it's all been extremely emotional, I think, really for the whole country, with everybody watching TV and watching to make sure that it goes through, and then seeing the responses of people and the emotions. In fact, I just saw a little while ago, 2 of the hostages who were released 2 nights ago were coming home back to their town, and the streets of the town were lined with thousands of people waving Israeli flags to welcome them home. There's a little boy, Ohad, who had his 9th birthday in captivity, and he was released, and there was a video of him running towards his father in the hospital. And then apparently the hospital said he could invite 2 friends for a little birthday party, and he said, no, I have a lot of friends. You have to let me invite all of them. And so these 10 little boys got together and had ice cream in the hospital. And you see the doctors, when they talk about the patients, the hostages, getting emotional, these doctors who deal with this all the time. So they say that the hostages are in relatively good health, with the exception of one 84-year-old woman who her daughter, who was released last night and taken directly to an Israeli hospital. Her daughter says she did not receive her medication and she's apparently in critical condition. The rest of them are in decent condition. They say that for the first month they had enough food. They cooked for themselves. They were held in different groups apparently. And then for the last 2 weeks, there's been much less food. They were sleeping kind of on like benches, not on proper beds or anything. And there was just a report that Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar visited one group of hostages in one of the tunnels who were being held in one of the tunnels that Hamas has built under Gaza and said to them in Hebrew, don't worry, this is the safest place in Gaza. Nothing's going to happen to you. But so it's a very emotional thing, really, for the whole country.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office released an announcement that said the Israeli government has approved the inclusion of 50 female prisoners in the list of possible prisoners for release should more Israeli hostages be released. Mediator Qatar said on Monday a deal had been reached to extend a truce between Israeli and Hamas forces in Gaza by 2 days, continuing a pause in 7 weeks of warfare that has killed thousands and laid waste to the Palestinian enclave. Reuters' Lauren Anthony reports.
A deal to extend a truce between Israeli troops and Hamas forces in Gaza by 2 days was agreed on Monday. That's according to mediator Qatar, which has been facilitating indirect negotiations between the two sides with Egypt. The agreement lengthens a 4-day ceasefire after 7 weeks of warfare, which has seen thousands killed and laid waste to the Palestinian enclave. Hamas also confirmed the extension. There was no immediate comment from Israel. The release of 11 more Israeli hostages seized by Hamas during its October 7th assault on southern Israel was confirmed on Monday. As dozens of Gazans rushed to get supplies from aid rations distributed by the UN on Monday, many described the dire living conditions that they expect to worsen if war resumes. Raider Mohammed Jamal Al-Jaburi is one of them.
We wish that the truce would be permanent and people would go back to their lives and to see each other. People have lost their families and relatives, and we are not able to reach our families. We don't know who we lost and who was still alive. We are coming here to try and get some clothes for our children because we left everything in our house. Children are wearing summer clothes. This is not right. God willing, the truce will be extended and will stay in place. We don't want more war. This is enough. This is so tough on us.
On Sunday, Hamas freed 17 Israelis, including a 4-year-old Israeli-American girl, and Israel freed 39 teenage Palestinian prisoners. The truce, agreed last week, is the first halt in fighting since Hamas attacked Israel, when 1,200 people were killed and 240 hostages were taken back into Gaza. In Jerusalem, Israeli Anat Errol is also advocating for a pause in fighting.
I'm against all violence, and I really hope that there will be ceasefire, and I really hope that it will continue to be ceasefire, because violence is not a solution for anything. I mean, I know that that those terrorists are like horrible, like they are, I can't even say they're, they need to, of course, personally they need to be punished, but not all the other people in Gaza need to be punished.
In response to the October 7th attack, Israel has bombarded the Gaza Strip and mounted a ground offensive in the north. As of Monday, Gaza health authorities say some 14,800 Palestinians have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced.
That was Reuters' Lauren Anthony. A man pleaded not guilty to attempted murder Monday in connection with the weekend shooting of 3 college students of Palestinian descent in Vermont, an attack that's being investigated as a possible hate crime. The 3 young men were shot and injured Saturday while walking near the University of Vermont campus. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King has this report.
ATF agents arrested 48-year-old Jason Eaton Sunday afternoon at his apartment building near the scene of a shooting on Saturday near the University of Vermont in Burlington. Police Chief John Murad says the 3 victims, all 20-year-old Palestinian-American college students, were speaking some Arabic as they were walking during a holiday visit when a white man with a gun approached them and discharged at least 4 rounds from a pistol without speaking. 2 of the 3 victims were wearing the black and white Palestinian keffiyeh scarves. The chief says in this charged moment, no one can look at this incident and not suspect it may have been a hate-motivated crime. He urged the public not to jump to conclusions. Police say evidence collected during the investigation, including the execution of a search warrant at Eaton's residence, gave prosecutors probable cause. I'm Jennifer King.
Authorities in India said on Monday that they were set to begin manual digging of what they hoped was the final phase of rescuing the 41 construction workers trapped in a collapsed mountain tunnel in the country's north for over 2 weeks. Mahmoud Ahmed is managing director at the National Highways Infrastructure Development Corporation. We want to do a manual excavation to remove the muck, move the muck through the pipe, and then push the pipe through the machine. So far, rescuers have excavated and inserted pipes after digging horizontally up to 46 meters. The pipes have been welded together to serve as a passageway from where the men would be pulled out on wheeled stretchers. We're following these other stories from around the world. China's health ministry says a surge in respiratory illnesses across the country that has drawn the attention of the World Health Organization is caused by the flu and other known pathogens and not by a novel virus. The ministry called on local authorities to open more fever clinics and promote vaccinations among children and the elderly as the country grapples with a wave of respiratory illnesses in its first full winter since the removal of COVID-19 restrictions. Polish truckers and farmers on Monday started a round-the-clock blockade of access to one of the busiest border crossings with Ukraine, extending a protest that has left over 1,000 lorries stranded for days in queues that stretch for miles. North Korea warned on Monday that it would continue to exercise its sovereign rights, including through satellite launches, while its troops were reported to be restoring some demolished guard posts on the border with South Korea. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Ekaterina Donsova, who wants to run for president of Russia, told Reuters the Kremlin should end the conflict in Ukraine, free political prisoners, and undertake major reform to halt the slide toward a new era of barbed wire division between Russia and the West. Reuters' Sean Hogan has more.
Ekaterina Donsova wants to end Vladimir Putin's reign and, in turn, the conflict in Ukraine. The former regional TV journalist hopes to be Russia's next president.
I expect that we will negotiate in the future. Any conflict, including an armed one, comes to an end sooner or later. I do wish it was over as soon as possible.
The 40-year-old announced her desire to run in next year's elections this month, but she told Reuters in this sit-down interview she is afraid and has been warned about speaking too much to foreign correspondents.
It is clear that any sane person taking this step would be afraid. But fear must not win, because there is a goal. And it is important to me not to cheat those people who write to me expressing their support, who call me their hope.
That hope includes a promise to free political prisoners and undertake major reform to halt division between Russia and the West. Russian laws can prosecute those who criticize what the Kremlin calls a special military operation in Ukraine. So Donsova refused to use the word war to describe the conflict. Choosing her words carefully, she says she is not a pawn being used to legitimize the election and denies any links to the Kremlin.
Despite the very substantial support for Putin, the people are very tired of what's happening. The families who lost their fathers, brothers, husbands, sons, they do suffer very much.
Donsova needs 300,000 signatures to stand in the March election. Russian state media ignore her. Putin is expected to run and is certain to win if he does. Opposition politicians cast the vote as a fig leaf of democracy adorning a corrupt dictatorship, saying such elections often draw in weak candidates to give the pretense of competition. Putin supporters dismiss that, pointing to independent polling showing approval ratings of over 80%.
Every day it becomes clearer that the laws will become tougher and that there will be fewer and fewer rights and freedoms. Some people may even like it because they do not need to make decisions. There is a category of people who are very comfortable when others make decisions for them. But we are talking about people who want to think. they are depressed by the situation when they can't speak or act freely.
That was Reuters' Sean Hogan. In Sierra Leone, a leading human rights defender says President Julius Maada Bio's speech to the nation appears to have calmed the situation following the military barracks attack by gunmen on Sunday. For the latest developments and analysis, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Abdul Fatoma, the executive director for the group called Campaign for Human Rights and Development in Freetown, the Sierra Leone capital.
This morning, the government put out a statement readjusting the curfew order. Now, curfew start at 6 a.m. and end at 9 p.m. So, meaning citizens have right to be out within 6 a.m. in the morning, and by 9 p.m. at night, you should be indoors. The Minister of Information says the security will continue to do their operations until they are fully in control. Then they will return life to normalcy back.
Did the President's speech last night calling on political leaders, religious groups, civil society to unite as a country against what he called attempt to destabilize the peace calm nerves in Sierra Leone?
Yes, the President actually emphasizing and stressing the victory by pushing these people out of the city and opening the country back today. He crowned it to all Sierra Leonean that we have claimed victory over those who attempt to attack our democracy and put this country under instability. And then calling on civil society, religious leaders, political leaders to come on board to fight against these enemies that want to bring instability to our country. So that helps to calm down a lot of nerves, and there's a little bit of changes in the tonation of government this time around than the previous protest or alleged coup by them. Because by them, he was saying that they know the people, they will go after them, they will hit them harder, and they know exactly it's coming from a group of politicians. But this time around, he's not blaming a group of political activists or a group of political groups at this moment. He's only calling on the nation and stakeholders to come on board to fight against these people.
Well, there are suggestions. Last year during a protest, the government called it an attempt to overthrow the administration. But this time around, an attack was carried out, the prisoners released. The attack occurred at a military installation where the attackers allegedly took weapons. And the attack basically happened close to the presidential lodge where the vice president's residence was also nearby with other diplomatic missions. Why are they not calling it an attempted coup this time? What is the analysis here? Talk to me about it.
That's the confusion among citizens here and analysts and political analysts are international security experts in Sierra Leone, because the Amourage was the attack and then ammunitions were taken away and vehicles, military vehicles, and they used those ammunitions also to break the prison and release prisoners, both from the female correctional center and also the male correctional center. And by then, government already has imposed a curfew order, you know, that we should not have people outside moving around. But the released prisoners were out working peacefully with no interruption and going to their different destinations. And then this very area, it's very close to the World Bank headquarters in Sierra Leone, the British High Commission, the Vice President office, as you rightly said, and very close to the presidential lodge and that of the U.S. Embassy as well. So it's scary to see that a group of people attacked the military barracks and took away some ammunition and used those arms, ammunition, and military vehicles to cause more havoc across the city, and also adopted police personnel.
That was VOA's Peter Clotty speaking with Abdul Fatoma, the executive director for the group called Campaign for Human Rights and Development in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. Former President Donald Trump plans to testify again next month in his civil fraud trial. His lawyer said Monday that he will return to the witness stand December 11th. Trump already testified aggressively earlier this month when he was called by his adversaries in the lawsuit, the New York Attorney General's office. This time, the Republican 2024 presidential frontrunner's own lawyers will open the questioning. They can ask a wider range of queries than they could on cross-examination last time. The state lawyers claim that Trump and his company misled lenders and insurers by giving them financial statements that greatly inflated his asset values and overall net worth. The defendants deny wrongdoing. And hundreds turned out to salute former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter on Monday on the final journey from her rural hometown in Plains, Georgia, to the Jimmy Carter Presidential Center in Atlanta, as her family began 3 days of memorials following her death November 19th at age 96. In an interview with the Associated Press, Paige Alexander, who's the CEO of the Carter Center, says Rosalynn Carter focused on women's rights and human rights.
She keeps a picture on her desk of a group of women protesting outside the White House when she was there against the Equal Rights Amendment. And I asked her, why do you keep that on your desk? And she said, to remind me of the work I have left to do. And for 40 years, she did that work.
At Sunday services at the Maranatha Baptist Church, former President Jimmy Carter's niece, Kim Fuller, says the passing of her aunt makes her think of the lyrics of the song Dancing in the Sky.
Because here on earth, it feels like everything good is missing since you left. And here on earth, everything's different. But I hope you're dancing in the sky. And I hope you're singing in the angel choir. And I hope the angels know what they have.
The former president, who is 99 and has spent the past 10 months in home hospice care, plans to attend a memorial church service Tuesday in Atlanta for his partner of more than 77 years, the Carter Center confirmed. Tributes started Monday morning as Rosalynn Carter's casket traveled by motorcade through the Carters' native Sumter County, where well-wishers gathered along the route in their small hometown and attended a wreath-laying ceremony at the college from which she graduated in 1946. And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Under the pretext of identifying a threat to international peace and security, representatives of the Russian Federation called a meeting of the United Nations Security Council to complain about a proposed amendment to an existing law under consideration by the government of Ukraine. The amendment states that should an aggressor country attack Ukraine and proceed to use any organization, religious or otherwise, to try to influence people and life in Ukraine, the Ukrainian government may dissolve such an organization. Under this law, claims the Russian Federation, the Ukrainian government could eliminate the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is directed from Moscow. Russia is trying to justify its atrocities and other abuses by framing its war of aggression as a holy war between good and evil, in addition to promoting the phony pretense of denazification of Ukraine, said United States alternate representative to the United Nations, Robert Wood. We should all see through this facade and focus on the well-documented and systematic policy of religious oppression in the territories under Russia's occupation.
Since Russia's invasion in 2014, its war of aggression has included repression of beliefs against Muslims, Jews, Orthodox, Catholics, evangelicals, and other religious groups. We are concerned about reports that Russia's occupation authorities continue to detain and physically abuse, torture, and imprison individuals on the basis of their religious beliefs or affiliations, and to baselessly apply extremist, terrorist, or undesirable designations against religious groups.
Bishop Ivan Rusin of the Ukrainian Evangelical Church has publicly mourned the killing of his church's pastors, noting that in Russia-occupied areas, the church has been forced underground, said Ambassador Wood. His plea was simple. Please hear our cry.
We must all hear it. We must all look at past Russia's disingenuous claims today to the facts in the many well-documented reports, including how Russia's relentless bombings and missile strikes have hit places of worship and other religious sites. Earlier this month, UNESCO reported it had verified damage to 124 religious sites in Ukraine, in addition to other cultural sites. The Ukrainian organization Heritage Emergency Response Initiative puts the total closer to 700.
As Russia's aggression against Ukraine continues, the Kremlin seeks to exacerbate divisions within the Orthodox Church and weaponize the faith of those Ukrainian citizens who belong to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, said Ambassador Wood. We urge the Kremlin to cease this senseless war of choice and respect the human rights of all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.